Hi, and welcome to episode 16 of the Unpacking Weight Science podcast called Dietary Quality, Measurement, Magnitude, and Meaning. I'm your host, Fiona Willer, weight neutral professional development dietitian, academic, and size acceptance advocate. In recent years, nutrition research has moved from a focus on nutrients to a focus on foods and eating patterns. Dietary quality broadly refers to the variety of food in somebody's usual eating habits. In this episode, I'll be bringing you up to date on the current state of play with this kind of research, how impactful dietary quality is on health outcomes, and how you can use it and measure it in your practice. Our learning goals today are to appreciate some of the methods used to try to quantify and analyze the way free-living humans eat, to understand the concept of dietary quality and the types of measurement tools used to capture the construct, and identify the associations between dietary quality, immediate, proximal and distal outcomes, BMI, and mortality. Think about what you ate for breakfast today, what you ate for dinner last night, what you had during the day yesterday. Did you also eat outside of those times? Do you eat that way all the time? Could you recall with any certainty how many milliliters your last coffee or last glass of milk was? Do you eat the same way now as you did 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago? Now think about the pure joy that is trying to condense all of that beautifully rich and complicated data into a single food and eating score with which to analyze your life and death. Sound tricky? It is. First, some history. Carbohydrate in the form of glycogen was first identified inside the body of mammals in 1856. The word protein was officially adopted in 1908 after 80 years of trying to isolate amino acids. Vitamins were first described in 1912, and that some fats are essential was discovered in 1929 after dietary fat had been identified as an important nutrient for humans in 1827. These times were highly exciting and provided much of the underpinning of our principles of nutrition physiology. Loads of scientists still devote their careers to trying to isolate tiny components in foods and physiological processes in bodies to try to understand things more. But we're not there by a long stretch. The mountains of research and the certainty with which some people talk about nutrition has given us a false sense of competence in the field. We know pretty much all of the basics, like what components are essential for life, how the major physiological processes happen, and how many dietary components are metabolized. But as we stretch out towards looking at what we know about the metabolism of rarer components or the less obvious parts of foods, and through to how we might use what we know to ask people to change their behaviors to influence their health decades into the future, the knowledge becomes much more patchy and we're less certain of what we know. The way that we measure what people eat has mirrored this pattern, from macronutrients to micronutrients to phytonutrients, becoming ever more focused on the smaller components, like a collective kind of hyperfocus. And this focus on the compositional aspects of food and diets has a name. It's called nutritionism. Think counting macros, carbs, antioxidants, all the things that we can't see or feel in foods and only know that they're there thanks to science. But in recent years, public health nutrition organizations have recognized the folly of divorcing the human and social context in which the food gets eaten from our interest in the nutrients in the food we eat. Rather than being focused on nutrients, food selection guides now acknowledge that we eat food, not nutrients. My observation is that this phenomena, discover a thing, try to find out all that we can about the thing, make sweeping recommendations based on the thing because it really seems like it's going to save humanity, roll out the thing and finally realize the thing isn't everything. This phenomenon is so human. I see it in dietetic students as they come into the course with their pet eating theory, gung-ho to change the world, and exit the course after 4 or 5 years realizing that maybe what I used to think might be a little unfeasible. The mark of a true expert is their confidence in expressing the uncertainties in their field. I can hear some of you thinking, yeah, but couldn't health at every size just be another fad too? Well, Hayes is non-denominational when it comes to identity diets and pretty flexible when it comes to medical nutrition therapy. Whatever someone wants to experiment with in their eating life is fine, but we call for them starting off their experiments with a good understanding of nutrition, behavioral and psychological science, and how those might interact given what they've experienced in their lives before. So I'm going to offer you a lens through which to think about eating when it comes to individuals. Of course, Choosing to eat in a particular way is not obligatory. This is for people who are freely choosing to lean in to explore the role that food plays in their life. Think about eating-related outcomes in terms of three categories. Immediate effects, so those that happen within a day or two. Proximal effects, those that happen within a month or two. And then distal effects, those that happen across years to decades. This framework provides a useful way to discuss the functionality of food in your client's life, and their issues can be framed this way too. Is their issue happening right now impacting on their day-to-day life? Is it a chronic issue that needs attending across weeks to months? Or is it a fear of long-term outcome, like losing a toe to diabetes complications or having a heart attack? So first, those immediate effects. That's the sort of within a day or two. How do my bowels work when I eat this way? How much energy do I end up with throughout my day if I eat like this? What kinds of foods are going to satisfy the kind of hunger that I have right now? What did I just eat that's left me feeling bilious? What the hell is this taste that's lingering in my mouth? How bad is my headache after I drink that kind of wine? Will my headache go away if I have some water now? Will my on-fire mouth be calmed down if I have some milk? Can I go faster on my bike in this competition if I eat this way just prior to or during the race? And does eating this way help me to feel connected to those around me? Etc., etc. These are all immediate effect issues. And working on the more immediate food effects is the most effective in terms of making behavior change sticky, because the benefits then are also experienced immediately. And once they're addressed, and if the person wants to do more, then they're free to choose to look at longer term eating effects. So next, the next type is the proximal effects, and that's the things that happen in the weeks and months to come. So this might be recovering from malnutrition, recovering from an illness, reversing a nutrient deficiency like iron, preparing for pregnancy or experiencing a pregnancy, or playing around with the things you eat and the way you move to see if you can impact on your blood sugar control, the HbA1c or cholesterol levels. It may also include preparing for a sports performance or event. And then finally, these distal or long-term outcomes of eating behaviours. These can include eating to minimise the risk of developing conditions that have a long lead-in time, such as osteoporosis, diabetes, heart disease, some bowel cancers, etc. And because it's easier to study things that happen in short time frames, we know way more about immediate and proximal eating effects than we do about distal eating effects. And in order for food to have a detectable effect decades down the line, it needs to be something that is consumed regularly or something that has a massive effect if it's consumed occasionally. And one of the reasons we were able to chase down the long-term effects of smoking was that it's something that people tended to do every day, and it also has a significant effect on outcomes. All of these types of effects of eating, immediate, proximal, and distal, are jumbling around for every individual and are not necessarily consistent with each other. Each eating opportunity is an opportunity to experiment and or make decisions about which is more important. Choosing to eat something that might make me feel physically not great for the short term in order to have the experience of eating it or connecting to others or simply responding to hunger in that moment. So how do we measure what people eat? First came weighed food records, where people weigh everything they eat, except that the very act of trying to measure everything results in people changing what they usually eat, or eating less because they can't be bothered recording it. And this is the effect of a food diary too, by the way. Or people eat things and don't write them down because we have this social shame scale for foods that results in people not liking to admit when they've eaten something that they suspect someone will judge them for. Humans do not possess the inbuilt skills to recall with any accuracy how much of something they ate either. We're not even very good at eyeballing a serving of food and estimating its weight or energy content. Even with careful training and practice, we're still reliably out by up to 20%. So realizing that, we developed the food frequency questionnaire, where people check off the kinds of foods they've eaten in a given time period and are interrogated a little about how much of those that they ate. Food frequency questionnaires are much more accurate at a population level, like almost all of these kinds of metrics, in which the underreporters are balanced by the overreporters, which means that the average is accurate for a population, but it's still pretty meaningless when it comes to extrapolating that back down to an individual. All that said, we have tried to do our best to understand the links between the types of food we eat and distal outcomes, those that happened years to decades away. The vast amount of knowledge we have about how bodies function and about how components in the food that we've eaten give us a faulty impression that we know how these two things go together. We try to figure out what is doing what? By using exploratory dietary pattern analysis, where a population's dietary habits are recorded using a food frequency questionnaire usually, then people are grouped by outcomes. For example, those with type 2 diabetes or heart disease, or those who have longevity, then the dietary data is interrogated for patterns that may characterize a particular outcome. So in that way, it's retrospective. You can think of this as a data-driven process as opposed to a theory-driven process, whereby we firstly define a definition of healthy eating and then look at the outcomes of those who eat this way. The benefit of making it data-driven is that you find things that you might not have expected, because by definition, any theory-driven analysis will only either find what it's looking for or not find what it's looking for. It can't create new knowledge, just confirm or refute a theory. Don't get me wrong, it's important to test theory, but it's not the be-all and end-all. You need both types of observations to be able to make a more confident assertion that a thing is actually a real thing. And then the final step, of course, is to get a bunch of people in whom you think the thing will have an actual effect and have them eat that way for decades to see if it does actually make a difference when it's an intervention instead of an observation of what happens to people just out there living their lives by themselves. This last part is experimental evidence. We have a lot of observational evidence. Our dietary guidelines are built on it, but we have much less experimental evidence of what happens when you apply those dietary guidelines to people who wouldn't otherwise have eaten that way. There is an argument that making recommendations based on observational evidence is low risk, and perhaps it is in terms of pure nutrition. But because food and eating are interwoven parts of human lives, the types of foods consumed cannot be amputated from the human and social operating system without consequences. So we've ended up with dietary guidelines that impress a kind of Western food ideal onto migrants with vastly different cultural norms and preferences when it comes to food. And then we wonder why that advice doesn't stick. Anyway, more recently, there's been a shift towards researching food patterns, the kind of foods people eat, rather than chasing down the nutrients in them. We're coming to realize that the relationship between food and human health is more than the sum of its nutrient parts. We now know that because we don't know everything, eating a varied diet is our best insurance policy against malnutrition. It's our best effort to ensure that our bodies come into contact with any nutrients and compounds that it needs to function. So in comes this concept of dietary diversity. How many different foods are you eating in a given time frame? So the higher the score, the higher the number of different foods consumed. And diet quality looks at this diversity as delineated by food group. That middle ground between analysing everything as accurately as possible and being able to actually capture someone's regular eating habits, in my assessment, is diet quality methods that score for dietary variety in a tick and flick kind of method. So the more types of foods you eat, the higher you score. These dietary variety scores can be divided by nutrient-related or food-type-related groupings into separate scores for each. So you get a score for fruit, a score for veggies, a score for types of fats and oils, etc. And this is the typical way that dietary quality scores work. Historically, though, what we've done is used two scores, one for the types of foods that are regarded as core nourishment or chronic disease risk reduction foods. So the more varied your intake of those foods is, the higher your core food score would be. And then there's usually a separate score for the variety of less health supporting types of foods you eat. In Australia, we refer to these in our Australian Guide to Healthy Eating as discretionary foods, basically the sorts of foods that get demonised when dieting: pizza, pies, soft drink, donuts, you know the types. The main dietary quality tools used here in Australia are based on the Australian Guide to Healthy Eating, and that's heavy on observational evidence but light on interventional research. But, you know, we use what we've got. So we've got the food groups used in the Australian Guide to Healthy Eating used in our dietary quality scores, and then we can look at between food group variety. So how many different categories of foods were consumed usually during the past week? Typically it's a week, and the groups are usually classified by similarities in nutrient profile. So like putting starchy tuber type veggies together in one group and leafy green veggies in another, for the ones where they categorize vegetables separately. And then we've got within food group variety, and that's how many different types of foods were consumed in each food group. So what's really exciting about this dietary quality research is that because we've got a score for the core foods and we've got a score for what we might term discretionary foods, so we've got our Australian measure for that, and they've got similar measurement tools, dietary quality indices that are used in different nations, and they're usually based on the nation's food selection guide. So they're quite sort of culturally appropriate for the setting as well, which I think is kind of elegant. And what we know from the research that's been conducted here in Australia and in other places is that that core food score is actually what's doing the work when we look at the relationship between food intake and death, essentially. It doesn't matter how much of the discretionary food you eat. If you've got a higher dietary quality score, your risk of all-cause mortality is lower. There's this beautiful summary of studies that was done by Kuretani and their team back in 2016, which looked at the dietary quality literature over the past 40 or so years. And they did this big review, and they found that higher dietary quality was related to a reduction in all-cause mortality by 11 to 42%, cardiovascular mortality by 17 to 60%, and cancer mortality by 11 to 40%. Which, I mean, that's amazing. If you think about the kind of public health campaigns we have here and that are run in typically in Western countries that demonise discretionary type foods, they're sort of focusing on the wrong thing. Really, if you were to look cold and hard at the evidence around how that relationship between core foods and these negative outcomes is, we would be focusing on trying to encourage people to consume more of the core food and particularly more variety in those core foods rather than demonizing these other things that actually don't make much of a difference. I mean, food itself is sort of, you know, fourth or fifth, maybe even further down the list in terms of things we can do that might shift our chance of dying sooner down the timeline a little. In terms of in food, what's doing the work, fruit and veg is doing the lion's share of the effect here in my reading of the research, followed by grain foods, and mostly because of their fiber component. And then on the neutral side, we've got white meat and dairy, which make virtually no difference at all. And then tipping it to the negative is red meats, and particularly if you burn them before you eat them. That's sort of the spectrum of the impact of food, but we're talking tiny effect sizes. So you'd never know. It would have to be 1,000 people eating that way to save a handful of lives lost to those sort of endpoints that we're trying to avoid. So if you like eating that way, awesome. If not, also, don't sweat it. As long as you're eating sort of varied and you're enjoying it and your body's working really nicely in the immediate time sense, then, you know, what more can you ask for? If we drill down on studies of diet quality here in Australia, we find firstly that the distribution of people who eat close to the guidelines, which is typically described as healthy eating, those that have marginal diet quality and those that have what is deemed poor diet quality, is pretty consistent across all the BMI bands. Same in the US, so about 10% of the population, regardless of BMI, eats a diet in the US against the, using the dietary guidelines index over there. They about 10% eat a diet consistent with what would be thought of as healthy eating. 90% don't, regardless of their BMI. Now that's not the sort of message that's told to us in public health. We are told that people in smaller bodies eat well and people in larger bodies eat poorly. But that is not the case. And it's not the case in US data. It's not the case in Australian data. It's not the case in UK data either. And further to that, in an Australian sample of adults over 49 years who are followed until death, and it's an ongoing study now even, they found similar results. So when they looked at all the dietary quality scores that they had for everyone in this cohort study, and they lined them up from lowest score to highest score, then divided their list into five even chunks, that's how you derive quintiles from data, they found a similar situation. When the BMI category was laid over it, there was very little difference between the proportion of BMI categories in those with higher quality diets and those with lower quality diets. So if the diet quality was reflected in body mass in the way that we're led to believe it should be, then higher dietary quality diet quintile would have had a clear overrepresentation of smaller bodied people, and the lower diet quality quintile would have been full of larger people, but it wasn't. Even better than that is that the people in the higher dietary quality quintile enjoyed a 21% reduced risk of all-cause mortality, regardless of their BMI. In that study, BMI made no difference to their lifespan, but eating a varied diet did. And using a really recent analysis of population data here in Australia paints a similar picture. And this time they divided the diet quality scores into three chunks, so tertiles, and found that there wasn't much difference between them in terms of BMI either. And I've linked that paper in your supporting materials. And really, when you look at it proportionally, there's hardly any difference, but there is just enough difference to get a statistically significant result. And I mean, we're talking about the difference between sort of 9% versus 11% across the different BMI categories. And so it's actually pretty meaningless clinically. And yes, there was a statistically significant difference between the proportion of lower weight versus high weight people in the dietary quality tertiles, but it remained that almost 40% of the poor diet quality tertile was made up of people with lower BMIs, and over 20% of the high diet quality tertile was made up of people with BMIs greater than 30. And also important is that the proportions were pretty similar to the proportions of people in each of the BMI bands. 40% had a BMI of less than 25, 35% had a BMI between 25 and 30, and 24% had a BMI of greater than 30. All of these proportions beautifully correspond with the middle diet quality category, with really the only small difference happening around the edges in the highest and lowest dietary quality category. The difference in the lower BMI category between high quality diet and low quality diet is 5.5%. That's it. So again, the more big evidence that eating a diet rich with what is considered to be health promoting foods does not result in a smaller body, and nor does it predict any particular body shape. So to sum up, we've had this obsession with the minutiae of nutrition for about 100 years and are now coming to realise that while this stuff is interesting, we need to remember that all food that gets eaten has to be administered by a human operating system, complete in its individual quirks and social and environmental context, before it gets close to making it into their body. The more we push to try to get accurate information about food intake, the more we influence what foods are chosen while they're being recorded, and the data becomes meaningless in the real-world setting. Indices of grouped food variety offer a handy middle ground where people select the foods they recall having eaten in the past week, but don't have to recall exactly how much. Remember that humans are singularly terrible at this. What we do know is that people's diets don't express themselves in the shape of their body, and that body shape doesn't dictate diet quality. We know this to be true in Australia, the US, the UK, and there's no reason it wouldn't stand everywhere else too. And we now know that it's not the discretionary foods that are impacting on mortality at a population level, but what makes a difference, if there is any difference to be had, is the inclusion of a variety of core foods. This finding is corroborated across many countries. Using the concept of dietary quality in your practice can act as a valid method to quantify their recent way of eating. So you can record it for a change over time, and also as a starting point for you to get to know the kind of food person they are, what aren't they eating but wish they did, and why. So that's it for this episode. The supporting materials, which include the show notes, research links, and self-test quiz, are available upfront for current subscribers, only $5 a month, total bargain, or can be purchased in a bundle if you're catching up later. See unpackingweightscience.com for details. And next time, episode 17 is Dieting, Illness, and Malnutrition at Every Size. Malnutrition is a condition that has both short-term and long-lasting consequences. In this episode, I'll unpack the science of malnutrition, its signs and symptoms, and as always, how our intentional weight loss focus results in dangerous malnutrition invisibility. Until next time, goodbye.